At the top of last week's episode of 4 Qubits and a Span, I plugged the Christadelphian Digital Expo that's taking place in Leicester on Saturday the 22nd of September. The team published the programme just a couple of weeks ago, and it looks like it's going to be a great day. There's also going to be live streaming. Details of that will be up on the website soon, if not already. There's a full day programme from 10 in the morning. There's going to be some practical demonstrations, live video streaming using a Raspberry Pi. There's going to be an introduction to audio-video recording services and a stall all about adding digital audio to printed magazines. You're all listening to a podcast right now, so that one should be right up your alley. There are also going to be 5 short presentations spaced throughout the day, as well as an intro and wrap-up session at the start and end of the programme. I'll be presenting an amateur's guide to podcasting for beginners by pre-recorded video. There's going to be a GDPR survival guide, which is important for anybody who manages mailing lists or subscription services of any kind. A couple of good friends of mine are going to be presenting as well, a web-based church program generator to assist in the practical day-to-day scheduling of church activities, and a guide to producing videos for social media. There's also going to be an overview of something called ChurchBox. I have no idea what that is. I'll maybe try and find out and tease that another day. Head over to the website www.techtoteach.uk. Check out the Facebook page, Christadelphian Digital. Check the show notes for this episode for all the relevant links. Hello friends, you're listening to 4 Qubits and a Span. I'm Dan Abson, welcome back to the show. And a very exciting show it is today too. It has been 1 year since the first weekly episode of 4 Qubits and a Span went out across the intertubes. It's only episode 33, you can thank Whooping Cough for that. But somehow I've managed to keep this thing going over the last 52 weeks. Thanks very much for showing up, thanks for subscribing, thanks for downloading and listening. Thanks for all the chat and all the feedback on the Facebook page and to my inbox and all the love on Twitter. I'm looking forward to year two, looking forward to digging deeper, to going in different directions, and hopefully to chatting with more of you over the coming months. Today we have got the readings for Sunday the 2nd of September from the Bible Companion Daily Bible Reading Planner. We've got 2 Kings chapter 7, Lamentations 3, and 1 Corinthians chapter 16. Because we're back into relatively familiar territory from the episode last year, I may occasionally refer back to last year's episode. When I do, I'll put the link in the show notes so you can get straight there. And as we go through the second year, I'm going to be trying to pick up maybe on some of the threads from the previous year and take them a little bit further to explore different directions. We'll see what happens. First then, 2 Kings chapter 7. This is actually a narrative that begins in verse 24 of the preceding chapter. Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, is invading Israel again, the northern kingdom, and he brings a siege against Samaria, the capital city. The king of Israel isn't named in this chapter, or actually in any of the surrounding chapters, in any of these narratives. We simply have the prophet Elisha interacting with the king of Israel on multiple occasions. If we go back until we find the name of a king, we go back to the beginning of chapter 3, and we have Jehoram, king of Israel. There was a Jehoram, king of Judah as well, who's sometimes called Joram in the biblical text. But I think it's notable that after that, after chapter 3, the writer isn't calling the king by name. He's not saying, Jehoram does this, King Jehoram does that. It's just the king of Israel. It's very generic. And each of these stories is very much treated as kind of a self-contained narrative. You have very generic introductions. So-and-so did this. Another person went to this place. This began to happen. You have introductions like chapter 6, verse 8. Once, when the king of Aram was at war with Israel, he held a conference with his staff, and so on. Here in verse 24 of chapter 6, where this story starts, but later Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, mustered his whole army and marched to the siege of Samaria. The writer isn't interested in locating any of these stories at a specific time or in a specific historical context. These are just stories about the king of Israel and the prophet Elisha. If we wanted to put a modern label on these stories, or if we wanted to describe this genre in some way, which is helpful in some ways because it gives us a sense of what to expect and how to read, as long as we realise that those labels are kind of anachronistic, we're placing our modern understandings of story and history onto this ancient text from a different world, from a different time, where those kind of literary genres weren't quite so clearly defined or even needed. If we were going to put a label on these stories, we would probably call them legend, just because of the very generic way that they're introduced. It's almost like a collection of vignettes, little scenes from the life of the prophet Elisha, and the identity of the king, the particular historical situation, isn't as important to the text as the content of the story itself, of how Elisha acts, of how God acts, and of how those around, particularly the king, react to them. Just to really kind of underpin that idea that we're not looking at a collection of stories that are historical in the sense that we would expect them to be historical, where kind of one thing follows another, and that describes the life and times of a particular king or people. Verse 23, the end of the preceding narrative in chapter 6, ends with these words: "From that time, Aramean raids on Israel ceased." Which is funny because, as we've already read, the very next story is the story of an Aramean raid on Israel. The editor or compiler of these texts has introduced this very next narrative with words to the effect of "but later" to kind of patch up the join between these two stories that really aren't connected chronologically in a modern historical kind of way. The plot of this story as well, where basically God frightens away the Aramean army that is besieging Samaria, and the king is very paranoid and thinks it's a trap and doesn't want to send anybody out because he thinks that as soon as they send people out, the Arameans are going to descend and slaughter them and get into the city. And so he very cautiously sends out a scouting party to backtrace the kind of Aramean marching trail. That's actually very similar to what the Israelite army does in chapter 3 to Moab. The Israelite army lures the Moabite army into their camp and then ambushes them. So if you're really looking for some kind of historical order here, you might want to put this story somewhere around there, and that would also put it before the end of the Aramean raids there in verse 23. But that does go to show that the writer or writers or compilers or whatever of this book aren't interested in presenting a chronological history. They're presenting things thematically. They're presenting these stories of God and his people for theological reasons. These are stories to teach, stories to inform, stories to engage, not just stories to describe history. Okay, on to Lamentations. Lamentations chapter 3. Now, we touched on Lamentations chapter 3 last year, mostly because when I was first putting the program together, I mistakenly wrote down Lamentations 3 instead of Lamentations 4, recorded 15 minutes on Lamentations 3, and then found out I'd done the wrong one. Ha! Hilarious. Well, this year we are legitimately in Lamentations chapter 3. Like the other poems in Lamentations, it's an acrostic poem. This is a complete acrostic, a triple acrostic, in fact. It comes in stanzas of three verses. Each stanza in this poem has three lines, each beginning with the same letter. So each stanza is represented by successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet. This is a really wide-reaching kind of poem. It does feature a kind of progression from one place to another place, but I think most of all it features the interplay of different ideas, of different approaches, of different views of the world and ways of coping with periods of great suffering and great trial. This poem has a voice. It's written in the first person. And in the first 20 verses, the poet presents this voice railing against God. This is an individual who takes up his lament that God is an abusive shepherd. "I am the man who has known affliction under the rod of the wrath of the Lord." That's like a shepherd's rod, a shepherd's crook. "It was I whom he led away and left to walk in darkness where no light is. Against me alone he has turned his hand, and so it is all day long." The shepherd is supposed to lead the sheep in a safe way, in the light, but this voice accuses God of being a shepherd who leads his sheep to destruction. "He has wasted away my flesh and my skin," and so on. Verse 7, he has hemmed me in so that I cannot escape. He has weighed me down with fetters. These are opposite ways of talking about God. This isn't a God of liberation. This is a God of imprisonment. This is a God who afflicts. This isn't a God who clears the way for his sheep to travel. This is the God who entangled my way. That's verse 9. And in verse 10, it gets worse. He lies in wait for me like a bear or a lion lurking in a covert. He has forced me aside, thrown me down, and left me desolate. The shepherd is the one who protects his sheep from wild animals. Here the shepherd becomes like a wild animal and attacks his sheep, attacks the character behind this voice. In the trial, in the tribulation that this character experiences, he sees the hand of God afflicting and casting down. This probably doesn't match how we think of God, or at least how we want to think of God. And the same is true for this voice that the poet presents. This character wrestles with what he knows of the love and compassion and character of God, and he takes up that kind of hopeful, plaintive voice in verse 21. I shall wait patiently because I take this to heart. The Lord's love is surely not exhausted, nor has his compassion failed. They are new every morning, so great is his constancy. Every morning is like a mini resurrection, a mini redemption, from the tiny death of sleep to a new day. The rabbinic commentary, Lamentations Rabbah, interprets this verse in the following way. Because you renew us every morning, we know that ample is your grace to redeem us. It makes that leap from God's daily redemption of a person from sleep to God's ultimate ability to redeem in his grace. And it's not strange that these things should sit side by side. This expression of hope in God, this attestation, this affirmation of God's loving character, alongside this lament and this accusing God of causing this suffering. That probably doesn't fit with how we want to read passages like this. The way that we really want to read scripture on the subject of suffering is probably to read passages that tell us that everything works together for good to those who love God, that God will not abandon his people, that God can always turn every situation around. But that's really not the narrative of Hebrew lament. And Lamentations is obviously the epitome of that. The section from verse 25 has this kind of pious apology for God, and it buys into this narrative that suffering can have positive effects. It is good for a man to bear the yoke from youth. You know, it doesn't last. Rejection by the Lord does not last forever, verse 31. God's in ultimate control. These are the things that we want to hear, aren't they? Who can command and have it done if the Lord has forbidden it? That's verse 37. Doth not both bad and good proceed from the mouth of the Most High? Why should any living man complain, any mortal who has sinned? Let us examine our ways and test them and turn back to the Lord. God's in control. If bad things happen, then we just have to be better people and God will see us and hear us and redeem us. This narrative is not one of harmony, it's one of contrast. If we read the whole passage and not just pick on these one or two verses that support this view or that view of suffering, we should be able to see that there are competing ideas here, that this is a poem that engages in a wrestling with God. It's not a way to glorify suffering, and so often verses like some of these are quoted in order to do that, to say that, you know, suffering is great, suffering is good, because suffering builds character. That's simply not true. This middle section of the poem, the expressions of faith and hope and pious wisdom, Tremple Longman III, in his Understanding the Bible commentary on Jeremiah and Lamentations, puts these verses in their place, describing these expressions of faith and hope as neither the beginning nor the final thought of the poem. It's not supposed to be the first word or the last word on suffering. It's supposed to be a view of suffering which competes and which the poet is wrestling with alongside all these other views of suffering, of the cruelness of God and the injustice of God there at the beginning of the poem. And in the following section, the voice moves from talking about only himself to describing also his community. That begins there in the verses we already read in verse 40. Let us examine our ways. Verse 41, let us lift up our hearts. Verse 42, we have sinned and rebelled. Verse 43, you have covered us in anger. Verse 45, you have treated us as scum and refuse among the nations. And as the poet brings in these thoughts of community in relation to those around, the narrative shifts again. The destruction and the devastation that come not as a result of what God does, but because of what the people round about do, because of what their human enemies do. Verse 46, our enemies all jeer at us. Verse 52, those who for no reason were my enemies drove me cruelly like a bird. To silence me, they thrust me alive into the pit. And so the blame shifts from God to the human enemies of this person, of this community. This is a big melting pot of lament and of ways of viewing suffering and looking at suffering. Here in this final section, the poem appeals to God to come to the rescue of the community, to come to the rescue of this person against their enemies. Really, really important to read this as a whole complete poem, because that's what it is, so that we're not picking out one idea, but being forced by this poem to wrestle with all of these ideas together. That's the whole point of Hebrew lament, is to wrestle with life in view of God, to find a way through that, to reconcile what we know about God with what we know of what's happening around us. That's much more complicated, much more challenging than simply saying everything that happens, happens for a reason. Because sometimes it doesn't. We all like to have pat answers for the question of suffering. I have some pat answers of my own. But what lament psalms like this do is make us take a step back to struggle with the complexity, with the nuance of being human, of being in a world where God is, and yet where God does not always act. That's hard emotional work. And while scripture can help us to do that work, it can't do the work for us. It's not going to give us a fully formed response for every situation that we find ourselves in. That's something that we struggle with on our own, that we struggle with in our communities, and that we work through from darkness to light. Okay, final passage for this week, 1 Corinthians chapter 16. This is Paul signing off and touching on something that we considered last year, this initiative to make a collection among the Gentile churches in Macedonia for the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem. You'll find references to that in Romans 15 as well, and a more extensive description of the collection and of Paul's purpose and intent for it in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. We're going to take a couple of points from that, but what I'd really like to do is look at this last chapter as telling us something about the nature of the early church, at least of the churches that Paul helped to found. We see different congregations who associate with one another, who know about one another, but we don't have a formal hierarchy or organization at this point. And there are lots of things in just this chapter that point towards that, that are quite striking. This collection that's being made is always presented as a voluntary collection. This isn't like a church tax. It's not even people paying into a communal fund that exists. Verse 2, every Sunday each of you is to put aside and keep by him whatever he can afford, so that there need be no collecting when I come. Paul advises them each to set aside something to add to the collection when Paul comes to collect it. This isn't a communal church fund that they're paying into here. And the way in which this collection is described, the language that it's associated with in the three passages that it appears, is not one of obligation, but one of gift, of fellowship, of ministration, or blessing. These are all words that are associated with this collection here and in Romans and in 2 Corinthians. This isn't something that the church is demanding of its members. This is something that each of the members who make up the church are setting aside as donations for their brothers and sisters. As always, at the end of Paul's letters, we have greetings to various individuals, and in 1 Corinthians, Paul spends a few verses talking about the Stephanas family, who he describes in verse 15 as the first converts in Achaia, who have devoted themselves to the service of God's people. 100 years later, there would be a formal hierarchy in place with bishops and deacons and elders that all report up this kind of pyramid of authority. But the picture that we have here of the Stephanas family and of how Paul advises the Corinthians to interact with them is very much one of a voluntary devotion, of personal service. In verse 16, Paul says, I urge you to accept the leadership of people like them of anyone who labours hard at our common task. It's very communal language. This is the language of a volunteer community, of a lay community, if you like. As well as Stephanus and his family, there's also Fortunatus and Achaicus, there in verse 17. They have raised my spirits, says Paul, verse 18, and no doubt yours too. Such people deserve recognition. Paul's telling them to recognize these people, to submit themselves voluntarily to these people, not out of kind of obligation, because they're ordained and put in a position of authority, but because they themselves are volunteers, that they have served and have benefited the church, have benefited their brothers and sisters, and for that reason they should be recognized, because of what they have done, not because of what they are or what they're called. And there's a final greeting to Paul's close friends Aquila and Prisca, and the church that meets in their house. The house church, of course, is the ultimate in non-hierarchical worship. This is Christian community in action, in a very profound kind of way. And that sense of mutuality, of community, continues. Greetings from the whole brotherhood. Greet one another with the kiss of peace. There's no formal hierarchy here. We have volunteers and house churches and people who should be recognized for their acts of service. That doesn't mean that this chapter can serve as an excuse for isolationism, that we can just live in our own little bubble or our own little house and collect our favourite Christians around us and just carry on that way. After all, the context of this chapter is of a cross-continental collection that unites two totally different groups of people. There are benefits of a wider organisation. You only have to look to the public health and public education provided by the monasteries in medieval Britain. But even small communities can have that wide reach and wide impact by associating with other small communities. That very much seems to be the model for Paul's churches here. And this really lands squarely in the theme of 1 Corinthians, as we were looking at last week. It's all about applying the Spirit of God, applying the mind of Christ, to applying the conscience of a Christian to everyday life. What can you do from where you are? Who can you reach out to? Who can you join with and act with so that what results is bigger than the sum of its parts? So 1 Corinthians 16 isn't a church guide for how to do church. It's an example of how communities, it's an example of how to build a community, of how communities can cooperate and work together to glorify Jesus Christ and to glorify God and to raise each other up. It's the perfect way to end a challenging letter, 1 Corinthians, to really put us on the spot and make it clear that the responsibility is ours to act. Thank you for joining me for the anniversary episode of 4 Cubits and a Span. I look forward to lots more conversations just like this one. Come back next week for 2 Kings chapter 15, a triumphant return to Ezekiel's prophecy, Ezekiel chapter 5, and the first chapter of Luke's gospel record. Don't forget to check out the techtoteach.uk website, sign up to the mailing list, like the Facebook page, etc. But if you haven't yet left a rating or a review on iTunes, go and do that first. Or on Facebook, you can leave a rating and a review there too. Come and chat to me on Facebook or on the website, www.4cubitsandaspan.com. Tweet me at Daniel J. Abson. Social media is a great place to build a sense of community, to practice what we preach, to serve together, to lament together, and to talk together, engaging with the story of the scriptures, where that intersects with the story of our own lives. Have a great week, and we'll speak again soon.